Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcioland Podcast. This is already our 175th podcast. So today, it's Thursday. We're going to take a look ahead to the weekend in Serie A. Thousand Names sent me some fire picks for this weekend, which starts early tomorrow with Juve Inter. We have some very good questions from our listeners and Twitter followers. I'm going to turn tables on Alex and ask him a question towards the end of that segment, because I want to hear what's going on with Sarri at Chelsea. And we're going to close it with an interview on Sarri's former team on Napoli. Interviewed our friend Aaron Gialanella, who's been on the podcast multiple times. We had a fun and interesting chat on what's going on with Napoli. But before we get to what's happening on the pitch, it's December. January transfer window's around the corner. This is the time of year where people are starting to look more to the winter transfer window, some potential moves. So Milan's been a lot in the headlines. Paqueta, they already closed that deal with Flamengo, but it looks like they're going to be quite active. So there's two players that they've been heavily linked to. So look, it's not out of the question that they sign both, but they come with expensive wages at least. And that's Cesc Fabregas and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. So I want to ask our great friend, producer, co-host of the podcast, Alex Goldberg, who's now a superstar with both his YouTube channel and his video on Twitter. Alex, let me ask you, if Milan could only have one between Fabregas and Ibrahimovic, who do you think helps them more when you look at their team overall and the ability of these two players right now?
It's a good question, David, because I'm never going to answer it so quickly, especially when Zlatan is one of the options. He is consistently a player that should never be doubted, no matter how old he's getting. He can certainly always make an impact, and his presence is always felt. If you know Zlatan, you know if he's in the room, he is the most popular guy in the room. If he's on the pitch, he's the most polarizing guy on the pitch. And I still think he could probably give Milan a handful of goals and improve them, maybe. But my answer is Cesc Fabregas. And if you're somebody who follows me on Twitter only for Chelsea reasons, you might be surprised by that answer, because I'm not too married to Cesc anymore. I definitely have players I like less than Cesc. I have no problem with him, but I've been quite vocal that he is really on the back nine. I think on an episode or two ago, I compared him to Kobe Bryant and the fact that Kobe got into the NBA at such an early age that once he was in his mid-30s, he was really older than he actually was. That's why everything went downhill so quickly. He had so much mileage on his tires, as does Cesc. He's been playing for a long, long time. I mean, it feels forever ago that he was on Barcelona, yeah, let alone killing it for Arsenal. So he has been around the block. But I still think he has something to offer to a Milan side. Now, if Milan were to acquire him, hoping that he can turn back the clocks and be a regista and throw assists left and right, that's not realistic. But he has showed in bits and pieces for Chelsea this season. He has not been great, and he hasn't even played much Premier League football, but he has showed he still, David, is one of the best passers in the world. And when I look at Milan's team right now, I see Bakayoko and I see Frank Kessie playing very well, but I don't see a Cesc Fabregas type player. Even if Bielia is healthy, I don't see a Cesc Fabregas. Now, Maurizio Sarri has spoken recently about the fact that he would love to keep Cesc for another year. I don't know if that was more just Sarri was asked the question and he's not going to say anything negative about the player. He's not going to stir the pot. He's going, and he grouped it in with David Luiz, two players he was asked about. He said, yeah, we'd love to keep him around. It's hard to find people of their quality, but he also mentioned their leadership qualities. And I think that's what it's more about. And I think if Cesc Fabregas went to Milan, half of the allure for Milan fans would be his leadership. He definitely is a guy that's not going to be fazed by the situation. And if Milan bring him in as a situational sub or a starter in non-Serie A games, I think they have something on their hands there. I don't think it's going to be a groundbreaking acquisition whether they get Cesc or Zlatan. But looking at Milan's current team, I think there's more of a need for Cesc Fabregas. He played last week in the Europa League. He was very, very good. He had two assists. Yesterday, he played in the Premier League, and he was awful. So I'm not saying you're going to get someone that is consistently going to improve Milan. But once again, looking at Milan's squad, considering the fact that Higuain is coming back, so Zlatan would not necessarily be this dire need at striker that some may think, I think there's more of a fit for Cesc, and I think he has a little bit more to offer. Maybe not necessarily on the pitch, but if you add on the pitch and off the pitch, I think he has more to offer than Zlatan does at this point. So, David, that's my take on it.
Yeah, no, I echo a lot of what you're saying. And as far as Sarri's quote, I'm with you. I don't see him ever saying anything bad about a current player on the team, stirring the pot, making it feel like he doesn't want a player to stay. And look, you know, last summer it made sense for Chelsea to look at some players that would fit Sarri's system, obviously trying to get his input because he got to a late start and we know what a big change was coming. But in general, rule of thumb, Sarri is not a manager that has wanted to be involved with transfers. This dates back to his time at Empoli. You know, just told the president, I'll coach whatever players you give me. At Napoli, granted, De Laurentiis likes to be very involved, but Benitez was also very involved with transfers, and Sarri clearly wasn't. So and in general, you know me, I don't put much stock in quotes on transfers. And I'm with you. I mean, Milan does need a striker because other than Cutrone and Higuain, they really don't have options. But to me, those two guys need to play a lot. And I think Ibrahimovic coming in, at least one of those two is going to lose playing time. And for a variety of reasons, I just don't see that as a huge net positive. So that's my take on that. You know, that being said, Milan needs as many good players as they can get. If they got both, that would be fantastic. But I definitely see a bigger need in the midfield for them, especially as you said, like a great passer, someone like that is really what they're missing since Bilia went out, and he's going to be out for a while longer. And for some reason, and I'm with you, Fabregas has been around forever. He's older. He's probably older than his age. He just strikes me as someone that would come to Serie A and actually do quite well. I think the style of play and Serie A is more suited for him at this stage than the Premier League right now for him. So he's been linked to Milan a lot in the past. He came pretty close to joining them even when Galliani was still there. So let's see. I know Atletico Madrid's also interested. That seems to be more for next season. Milan would love to acquire Fabregas now. We know they have a great relationship with Chelsea. They have a lot of stuff going on, not just by Koyoko. I don't see, you know, Fabregas being a big factor if Chelsea were to go after Suso. But, you know, it's all about lines of communication and having good relationships between the clubs. And they definitely have that. Some agents that work with Milan players also work with Chelsea. I'm thinking about Lucci and Pastorello. So, you know, and Leonardo seems to be talking directly to Chelsea as well. So I definitely expect to see some stuff going down between Milan and Chelsea. So to our listeners, you know, January window's coming. I know a lot of you guys, even some of you that don't necessarily follow Serie A closely, you know, our slogan is, you know, come for the transfers, stay for the calcio. So send us transfers on question. Send us questions on transfers, and if you listen to the answer, maybe the calcio stuff will interest you as well. And, you know, tomorrow we actually have a great game coming up, maybe as good as it gets in Serie A, the Derby d'Italia. We have Inter traveling to Turin to face Juve. So I have to ask you, Alex, A, what are you most interested in seeing in this match, and what's your prediction?
All right, well, right off the bat, I feel like when you've asked me what am I most looking forward to seeing in some specific matches, a lot of the time I've said the approach of the team, and someone could roll their eyes and say, oh, what a boring answer. But David, considering the fact that Inter have a very important Champions League game on Tuesday against PSV, I am interested in the approach from Spalletti in this game. Now, obviously, Juve are the favorites. Juve are the favorites against any Serie A team. We already know that. And not to mention, Juve they are also at home. So it's an uphill battle regardless of what Inter have midweek. But where will their focus be? Will they almost just say to themselves, eh, whatever, Juve's running away with it. Let's try for a draw because they still need to fight for second and third place. But are they going to be realists and think to themselves, we got to put our eggs way more into the PSV basket, the Champions League basket, or are they really going to try to go for a statement win? I'm not saying both can't happen. Sure, they could beat Juventus and still be just as focused on Tuesday, but these are all humans we're talking about. It is so hard not to look ahead to sometimes in a more important game, and I put that in quotes because a game against Juventus is never not important. But beyond the approach, I just want to see right out of the gates, what happens if Juventus go up a goal? What happens if Juventus take commanding lead and it once again feels like no one's going to beat Juventus? I want to see how Inter react to that. So now getting to my prediction. Oh boy, I know it's going to be boring, but honestly, I think this is a 1-0 win for Juventus. And I'm sure there are many people rolling their eyes because I feel like Juventus are just the kings of 1-0 victories. But David, I got to be honest, that's what I see. What about you?
Yeah, I'm going to give you my prediction when we do the ones with 1,000 names, but I will tell you the Champions League angle, you make a very good point there. Like, Juve's already qualified. I definitely think they want to finish in first place because you look at how the other groups are breaking down. It's very important also because of the fact that, you know, potentially if the other Serie A teams go through, Juve can't face them in the next round. So it becomes really imperative that they finish first. But they go to Switzerland to play against Young Boys. Manchester United is kind of all over the place. But Juve, I'm sure the Champions League is important to them as well. For Inter, though, as you said, it's probably a bigger deal, and they have a lot of stake there. They don't fully control their destiny either. So that's going to be very interesting. You talked about the approach, even the lineups. Let's see what happens. Maybe Inter rest some of their players. Looks like Perisic won't be. Maybe De Vrij will also be out. We'll see how that goes. But that should be really pretty interesting there. I'm curious to see what the midfield, how that looks. You know, we're going to have João Mário, who would have thought could be actually a very intriguing factor. When I was getting prepared for the podcast, I was thinking, you know, how fascinating is the two key players in the midfield, which could be João Mário and Bentancur, who would have thought at the beginning of the season. I know Bentancur is a little banged up, but by Allegri's press conference, it sounds like Bentancur and Imre Can are going to maybe play 60, 30 minutes each, something like that. So let's see what happens there. But, you know, with Nainggolan out, this could be another great opportunity for João Mário. So I think, you know, if you want a competition in Serie A the rest of the way, this is one of the times where Inter really needs to come through, because if Juve can get past this round still maintaining a huge lead, it's going to be tough. You know, I just don't see a big Scudetto race this year. But if it doesn't, if teams don't start catching up a little bit now today, it might become a little bit too late. So let's start making some predictions. You made yours, Alex, and our friend 1,000 Names really on fire this week. Send me his picks. By now, you guys know how it works. 1,000 Names sends me 3 games. He picks the matches that we pick. I have the advantage of knowing his prediction ahead of time before I make mine. And by the way, I loved that last weekend after Ronaldo scored on the penalty that people were tweeting him. So let's start with the big match. Juve-Inter, 1,000 Names has it 0-0. No surprise, Ronaldo's going to miss a penalty. It's going to be a Handanovic show. And he says that Spalletti is going to destroy Allegri's Catenaccio, his defensive philosophy. And he said that if there was an honest referee, he would have even won this match. In Italian, Juve-Inter, 0-0, Ronaldo sbaglia rigore, Handanovic show, Spalletti annienta il Catenaccio di Allegri e con un arbitro onesto avrebbe pure vinto. I'm going to have a Juve win. I'm going to have it 2-1. I'm going to be pretty boring. I'm going to have a goal, 2 goals by Ronaldo and 1 by Politano, who I think has been quite good this season. So that's the first match. Then 1,000 Names decided to pick Milan-Torino. He has it 1-0 with a penalty by Kessié. And he says this is another gift of a penalty for Gattuso, that Mazzarri is going to be so much on the hot seat, he's going to be one step away from being sacked. and that the magical fat boy Higuain is going to continue not to score because he's a complete bust. In Italian, Milan-Torino, calcio rigore, altro rigore farlocco per Gattuso. Mazzarri vede l'esonero, Mago Pancione e Higuain continua a non segnare. Bidonissimo. This is a tough one because Torino have been playing well recently. They are on a good roll. They are starting to make up some ground in the standings. I'm going to be bold. I'm going to have this as 0-0 as a draw. Torino's been in a lot of draws, and I'll pick that one. Last match picked by 1,000 names. Cagliari-Roma in Sardinia. He has Cagliari winning 1-0. Goal by João Pedro, and he says Di Francesco is once again going to make a terrible impression. And he says that Cagliari coach Maran is going to take off without Barella, who is suspended for this match. And he says that Schick is ridiculous. That's not in a good way, in a bad way. So in Italian, pronostico Cagliari-Roma 1-0. João Pedro, Di Francesco ancora beffato, Maran senza Barella vola. Chic ridicolo. Now, we know Roma struggled a lot against the lower table teams. They did show some character against Inter. They came back twice being down goals. So I'm going to have this as a draw. Cagliari has been a good, solid team. They've been good at home. I'm going to have it 1-1, goal by Pavoletti off a header, his specialty. And I'm going to give under a goal, although I trashed them a little bit on Monday's episode. I'm going to go with the David jinx that he's going to make me look bad. And someone who never looks bad and who never makes us look bad is our listeners who send in Twitter questions. I always like to say you guys in a lot of ways are co-writers of the podcast with me because you guys send us really interesting question. We get great feedback on them. So as always, you want to send us a question on Serie A transfers with the window coming up, TV, music, films. We got a couple of those today. Also podcasting and journalism. Just please use the CalcioLand hashtag. It makes it a lot easier for me to find them. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this one. Should Inter bench Perisic because of his poor performances since the World Cup?
You know, this isn't the worst idea in the world. You know, I also wonder, you know, if Perisic is a little bit tired. That was a deep run in with Croatia in the World Cup. He also was banged up. I remember that match at Camp Nou against Barcelona. He definitely didn't look 100% fit. Kita Balde's on fire right now, like really, really on fire. Politano, like I mentioned in the picks, has been doing quite well this season. Inter also could try to play with two strikers. Lautaro Martinez and especially his dad would probably really like that, to try to see him playing next to Icardi as opposed to being Icardi's caddy. So this to me isn't the worst idea in the world. I'm still a Perisic guy, but he does look not himself. I also wrote about him today on Euro Fantasy Game. I had a column on 5 Serie A players underachieving. So interesting there, you know, with Perisic, you also have to wonder long-term with him because, as I mentioned, Kita Balde, Politano have been good. Caramon, who's on loan at Bordeaux, is tearing it up. He looks like a long-term piece. So, you know, Perisic, too, is never afraid to talk about the Premier League in interviews. So who knows? If this continues, this might be his last season at Inter. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, I think he could be tired. I think you're onto something there. David, what does the contract between Milan and Sevilla for Andre Silva really say?
So, look, guys, I haven't actually seen it, but, you know, all the reports and Sevilla's director, president, have said they have the option to buy him $35 million, which is pretty steep. But if he keeps playing the way he is, especially when you consider his age, definitely a good bargain if he continues these performances. So they have the control. You know, in this case, the player's will counts for a little bit. I don't know how eager Andre Silva is to get back at Milan. I also don't know if you can have two young strikers like Andre Silva and Cutrone unless your plan is to play them together, because I think those guys need to play. So I don't know. I think, you know, with fans, when you look at transfer rumors and look at situations with transfers, it becomes very easy just to look at the perspective of your favorite team. But put yourself in the shoes of Sevilla. They take him on loan. They take a gamble saying, okay, let's see what he can do. He's been great for them. They have this option to buy. If it was the other way around and Milan had a player from Sevilla, if you were on this on these same terms, if you're a Milan fan, you're like, yeah, absolutely, we're going to redeem him. So as far as I know, this is the situation. So as much as it burns to see someone on loan with an option to buy that used to, you know, still technically own playing this well, this is what happens. You know, it's possible that Andre Silva is just one of those strikers not suited for Serie A. It doesn't mean he's not a very good player. It just, for some young strikers, it just doesn't click in Serie A.
Yeah, I feel like for strikers, that's the most true. Sometimes it just might not be a specific team or league for them. That's the situation with strikers, in my opinion. All right, David, this is interesting. With Zaniolo and Lorenzo Pellegrini excelling in the Trequartista role, should Roma look to unload Pastore in January?
Yeah, I think, look, if you took the financial aspect out of the equation, sure, makes perfect sense. Zaniolo, I actually think, and look, he played as a more advanced role against Inter. I still think ultimately Zaniolo is going to be an amazing mezzala. So a little not as a trequartista, like a regular midfielder, like in a midfield three. The guy that we call a regista, not every team has a Pirlo-type player in the middle. Mezzala, someone who's on the left or the right of that central midfielder. I think that's where Zaniolo is ultimately going to be. But Lorenzo Pellegrini has been excellent in the 10 role since he ironically replaced Pastore, who was injured in the last derby against Lazio. But the problem is the finances. Roma invested a lot in Pastore. I could be wrong. I think it was over 25 million. His market can be good after he's been injured, which not every, but pretty much almost everyone saw coming. He also has very high wages. So I don't know. I mean, if there was no financial ramification to this, then no brainer. But I don't think it's quite that simple. But look, Roma needs talented players. They need guys that can make a difference. And look, a healthy Pastore can make an impact. So let's see what happens there. But I just don't see him moving in January. It'd just be too hard to get back the amortized value left on his deal.
All right, David, this listener wants to ask, can I suggest that Roma and Lazio just switch coaches?
It's intriguing. You know, this made me think about the book Paolo Candal wrote on Totti. Really, really great book. And, you know, there's a long chapter on Zeman's impact on Totti. And when Roma hired Zeman, like he had previously coached Lazio, there was a lot of reservations how the fans would accept them, and they didn't really at first, but Zeman, he was at Roma a few times, but the first time did quite well, and actually Totti said what a huge impact Zeman had on him, especially on his body and his physical preparation. But I think Simone Inzaghi also, because he played for Lazio, wasn't just their manager. I just don't see it happen. Obviously, this is a hypothetical, but it's important to remember, like, really the strong rivalry between the two fan bases. And also, I don't know if Lazio would go for Di Francesco. I mean, remember, Lotito likes to get pretty creative with coaches. I mean, the only reason Simone Inzaghi's there is because Bielsa stood him up. I mean, Bielsa was officially announced at Lazio and then decided not to come. And Lotito had Simone Inzaghi on his other club in Serie B and brought him over. And, you know, although this season it's been a mixed bag, and maybe I'm being generous, overall Simone Inzaghi did well. So when Simone Inzaghi goes, I have a feeling Lotito is going to try to go for a big foreign name. That seems to be his initial instinct.
All right, David, next Twitter question. What do you make of Isco being linked to Juventus, and what does the future hold for my boy, Alexandro?
You know, January's coming. Alexandro question. I use the word amortization on a podcast, so it's coming, guys. So let's start with the Isco part. Obviously, great player. Obviously, Juve, very good relationship with Real Madrid. We saw the difference, Ronaldo, Juve, and Inter's attempts with Modric. You saw right there the difference in the two clubs' relationship with Real Madrid. Obviously, finances also a factor there. So, yeah, but then on the other hand, just look at Juve's attack, offensive-minded players. Like, they are so loaded. I mean, someone would have to leave. I mean, Isco right now isn't playing at Real Madrid. I'm sure if he leaves, he's going to want to play. And it's amazing to say, but Juve now is so stacked that that's not a club where it would be automatic. So I don't see it. Maybe down the road they discuss something with Dybala and Isco. I don't know, but I definitely don't see it in January. As far as Alexander, I definitely don't think he's going to be moved in January. I think this is Juve's team. They're going to go all in to try to win the Champions League. But they are looking for the future, and they love Benfica's left-back Grimaldo. They've sent the scout to watch him. He's a Mendes client. Huge plus for Juve because they have a very good relationship with him. So I think maybe down the road, maybe in the summer, we see this Grimaldo coming in and Alexandro potentially leaving. He hasn't signed the contract extension. I've been asked about this contract extension since two summers ago. Still hasn't happened. So if I had to bet, this is probably Alexandro's last season in Serie A. The Premier League makes a lot of sense. So does PSG. I know, Alex, you and I feel pretty differently about Marcos Alonso, but I don't know. I know someone had tweeted me when they look at the landscape of the PL, the top teams, they seem to kind of be set in Alexandro's role. So I don't know. You would know better than me, Alex. I know you'd welcome him. You'd love maybe nothing more than to have him at Chelsea. But overall, it doesn't seem like the easiest landscape for him in the Premier League. So I wouldn't exclude Paris Saint-Germain, though. That I'll tell you that much.
Seems like PSG would just be an easy fit for him, and there'd probably be no adjustment time period. He'd probably just hit the ground running. But yes, you mentioned Marcos Alonso. And listen, I have over time when he's been on Chelsea, I have defended him and I've bashed him. This week, he couldn't have been worse in two games. Disaster class after disaster class from Marcos Alonso. I promised a few episodes ago on this very podcast that I wouldn't take the bait on Alexandro. I lied. I'm back in for Alexandro. Let's do this all over again. Why the heck not? David, next question. Do you think Juve will sign a midfielder in January?
I think the fact that Bentancur has played so well, Emre Can's coming back from injury. We know how much Allegri loves Khedira. If I had to say more likely yes or no, I would say more likely no. If someone does come in, though, it would be a minor deal. It would be like a Thomas Rincon type deal, in my opinion. I think maybe they need an extra body there. But assuming Emre Can can stay healthy, we know Khedira is always, you know, one step away from his next injury. It would be a minor move if it happens. I wouldn't expect anything significant. I think the Juve team you see right now is most likely the team you're going to see, you know, the rest of the way. We've also seen Cuadrado kind of do pretty well in the midfielder role. So, again, I wouldn't expect anything substantial in general from Juve in January.
All right, David, this is a very interesting Twitter question. Who is the best current Bosnian player in Serie A and the best ever?
So I think it's going to, the answer for the best ever has to be in the current group. I did do a little bit of research. The only somewhat significant one that's not in right now is former Juve and Bayern Munich player Salimadzic. But other than that, it's the current one. It's actually a pretty good crop. We have Lazio captain Lucic. We have an intriguing player on Empoli, Krunic. And I think if we have to decide who's the best current and ever, it has to come down between Dzeko and Pjanic. And Dzeko's not having a great season. I'm not, you know, I like Pjanic, don't get me wrong. I'm just not as enamored with him as a lot of other people. I just find him a little bit inconsistent and disappearing in some big games. So I'm going to say current. I'm going to say Pjanic just because Dzeko really hasn't been that good this season. But I am going to say Dzeko is the best ever.
That's fair. That's a good shout. He certainly has been very good in Serie A. All right, David, let's move away from football. Is it me or are TV seasons getting shorter and shorter? I remember when shows had 25 episodes a season.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. But I think this is the main reason for this is that everything changed with Sopranos and HBO and cable shows having, you know, cable stations like HBO, Showtime, even A&E doing these prestige TV shows. Now we're seeing Netflix doing their own shows, Amazon Prime, and they tend to be much shorter seasons. While network TV, they need to fill full calendar years, that, you know, not full calendar year, but a full season, which usually goes from September to June. So obviously they needed many more episodes. I think it's really just the shift. I mean, I never watch network TV anymore. I can't remember the last time I've watched a network TV show, yet alone anything else, to be honest, unless it's sports. So I think that's really the difference. To me, Sopranos, HBO changed everything. We have these shorter seasons, 7-8 episodes. And another reason why the seasons are shorter, it's also the contracts for the actors and everyone involved on the credits on the show. You know, the how much they are paid changes season by season based on subscribers, prestige, or whatnot. So they don't want to be locked into contracts where they're paid X amount per episode, depending on how the season goes. So he's definitely right. It has changed. But as far as I know, those are the reasons why.
All right, David, last Twitter question. Where do you rank Ozzy Osbourne amongst rock frontmen?
So I think it was Monday that it was Ozzy Osbourne's 70th birthday, man. Pretty amazing. You know, in some ways, I almost felt like maybe he was older than that, which he's been around forever. I mean, he goes back to the late 60s with Black Sabbath. You know, a lot of people maybe know more as like the reality TV star. And then you find out about, you know, the heavy metal stuff and all. But, you know, as far as where he ranks among great rock frontmen, this isn't just, you know, live in general, but his legacy. I mean, it's really, really impressive. I mean, A, Black Sabbath in a lot of ways invented heavy metal as we know it. You know, Led Zeppelin, a little bit, but the really more heavier, darker subject matters was really Black Sabbath. He was in the original lineup, even the vocal style. I remember when we did our first episode with Andrew Barker, and we were talking about Chris Cornell right after he died, and he brought up, you know, how Chris Cornell was similar to Ozzy Osbourne. That never dawned on me as a singer because, you know, obviously Chris Cornell had an amazing voice, but the style, that had never dawned on me. Like, he's really influential, and Ozzy doesn't have as beautiful a voice, nowhere near as close as Cornell, but the style, that makes a lot of sense. So he had definitely a lot of impact there. Great frontman live, has definitely huge love for his audience. I was listening to for a podcast, like I forget which band that was an opener for him in like the late 90s. And Ozzy, after the opening band finished their set, asked them, is there anyone out there in the arena? Like, he was really worried that people would be actually pay to go see him live. Like, he was very insecure and genuinely loved his audience. So if you watch any videos of Ozzy live, like, you could tell it's really not an act. Like, I think he has a really strong bond and love for his audience. So he has that. Another thing is, you know, he was one of, you know, rock acts saying that it's their retirement tour. That's before Ozzy. You know, Kiss did it, other acts. But Ozzy made a really big deal about this in like the early 90s. He has a live album called Live and Loud, which is a really good album. And that was supposedly his last show. And this was like 93. I mean, here we are in 2018. He's still touring. So to me, this whole thing of like the BS retirement tour, he definitely had a lot to do with that as well. And finally, you know, when I think of his legacy is the amazing guitar players that he's had in his career. I mean, Randy Rhoads, the guitarist he discovered after he left Black Sabbath. I mean, he really changed everything. You know, we had Eddie Van Halen, but Randy Rhoads in a lot of ways took it an extra step. Really, really influential. He died very young. After that, Ozzy had a lot of amazing guitar players. The one he's had on and off recently, Zakk Wylde, to me is one of the best living guitar players. So he gave us a lot of guitar heroes. So for those of you that know him more for the reality TV show and his wife, Sharon, being on Howard Stern, like, you know, this was a good question because it made me look back to him. But before we get to our interview on Napoli, which I think you guys are going to enjoy, I have to ask you, Alex, you know, there's been a lot going on with Sarri. I have to say, I had some reservations on him when he arrived at Chelsea. We did a special episode on that. You and I talked a lot about it. Definitely exceeded my expectations. I think Chelsea adapted really, really well to his style. But now it seems, you know, that the first struggles are starting. So I have to ask you, how worried are you about this? And I have to ask you, Alex, because you know a lot about him from his time at Napoli. We covered it extensively. Do you feel you are more worried about Sarri because of what you know of him at Napoli than, say, the average Chelsea fan who doesn't know maybe so much about what happened when he was at Napoli?
Yeah, it's a good question, David, because you're right. On the surface, everything's going pretty well if you take into account the fact that Sarri is a brand new manager and obviously a very competitive league, and they didn't lose their first game in any competition up until the other week against Spurs. Yesterday, Chelsea lost a very disappointing game against Wolverhampton, but that's still just the second loss of the season. So on a whole, it's still been a successful season. But as you said, I do kind of know his weaknesses, and I put that in quotes because he definitely is a good manager, but I know some of the things he struggles with because of his time at Napoli. Now, one of them would be his lack of rotation. Now, I would say it's definitely something that concerns me from time to time, but yesterday he actually very much impressed me with his rotating. He started a player by the name of Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who deserved a start, but many thought wouldn't get a start because Sarri was kind of married to either Mateo Kovacic or Ross Barkley. But actually, he did something very surprising and gave the deserving younger player, that's key, a start. So I think in a way, Sarri is trying to correct some of his quote-unquote weaknesses. Another weakness, though, that I think is going to take a little bit longer to correct, David, and maybe he'll never correct it, is the fact that he might not be the best in-game manager. He is very well known for his 4-3-3, quote-unquote, Sarri ball, a very attacking, aesthetically pleasing style of football. But when teams approach him well, when managers have good approaches to his system, how can he then readjust? And so far, I can definitely say some Chelsea fans, including myself from time to time, have been unimpressed with his ability to adjust in-game. His in-game management hasn't been great so far. But I do have a little bit of faith that it will get better because I think it simply just has to get better. And I think maybe his product on the pitch would look a little bit better if he had more players suited to his style. He has put so much on the plate of Jorginho, and rightfully so. Jorginho is the only player who really has lived and breathed Sarri ball before. So this is going to take time. So I think most of the Chelsea team, David, is still tailored for Antonio Conte and Jose Mourinho. It is a defensive roster, you could say. And I know roster is an American term, but it's a defensive roster. There's a lot of overhaul the board needs to do. And I think a lot of it is unfair criticism so far in Maurizio Sarri. So in answer to your question, David, I do have some worries because there are players I want rotated in that I'm not sure Sarri will rotate in because he can be stubborn. And right away, he feels the hot seat. Any Chelsea manager that accepts the job, unfortunately, feels the hot seat. We all know Chelsea's reputation for sacking their manager every 2 to 3 years. So that could hurt Sarri and his rotating. But this is something to chew on. These are the lists of how many points these managers in the Premier League had after their first 15 games in charge. In 13-14, when Mourinho took over Chelsea again, Mourinho had 30 points after his first 15 games. Pochettino in 14-15 had just 21 points after 15 games. Jurgen Klopp in 15-16 had just 23 points after 15 games. Pep Guardiola in 16-17 had 30 points after 15 games. Jose Mourinho for Manchester United in 16-17 had 27 points after 15 games in charge. How many does Sarri have? 31. He's beating the rest of the pack. So he is still off to a better start than all of those managers, and two of them, in Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp, are doing just fine now. So I'm a little concerned, but I'm not nearly as concerned as many reactionary fans on Twitter. And David, I must admit, I think I've made an eternal pledge to not get on the manager for at least 2 seasons because of what happened with the previous manager. So that's my answer. I'm kind of concerned, but I'm not really concerned about Sarri. I'm more concerned about the Chelsea board.
Okay, very well said. So before we get to Sarri's former team, I want to thank all the listeners. On Monday, I challenged you to leave us some reviews on iTunes, and you really came through. It's a huge help. I know, guys, you guys hear me say it a lot, but there's a reason for that. So thank you. Keep those coming. It really helps us. So now here's our friend Aaron Gelinella. We are going to talk about Sarri's former team, Napoli, a lot of interesting stuff. And I look forward to chat. Alex and I look forward to chatting with you guys on Monday. Okay. And for the interview part of the podcast, you guys know that we like to check in on the big teams fairly regularly. We have different guests to give us perspective on teams that they follow closely. And today I'm joined by one of my favorite guests on the podcast, Aaron Gelinella. You guys know him on Twitter as Rat di Campania. We've had him on many times. Not only is he someone that follows Napoli very closely, he also works at DC United as a scout, someone who follows the game very, very closely and has a strong understanding of it. So, Aaron, it's a real pleasure to welcome you back. How you doing, for my friend?
I'm doing great. In New York right now. Love it here. Great to be back on the podcast. Spend some time. So I'm really excited to get down to business, talk Napoli, talk our season so far. So thanks again for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. So let's start big picture, and then we'll kind of zero in on a couple of topics I want to get your opinion on. So simply put, we're about a third of the way into the Serie A season. Napoli is set to be playing their last Champions League match in the group stage. They control their own destiny. So tell me, based on, you know, if I took you back to the beginning of the season, if I told you this is where Napoli would be, what grade would you give it? Would you be pretty happy with what you've seen so far?
Yeah, I'd say, I want to say like a B plus, but like a very good B plus, with potential to get more over to the A range. Because I think when you look at what we've done so far, undefeated in the Champions League, 110 out of the first 14 matches, like those are pretty good stats right there. The losses we had in the league against Sampdoria and Juve, I don't really have any issues with that. Both teams outplayed us those games. Wasn't really a question about us being horrible, but rather them coming to play and just being on their game. I think we should have beat Red Star away in the Champions League.
Yeah.
And really should have had that little bit of concentration at the end versus PSG. They did score that late equalizer to put us in that position where it's a little bit uncomfortable to play Liverpool. But that being said, I still have faith that we'll go through, and that's a pretty big achievement, because if you recall, Sarri and Napoli weren't exactly known for their top performances in Europe.
Yeah, I certainly agree there. So in Serie A, you know, last year, as everyone listening who follows Serie A closely knows, we had an amazing title race up until the very end. This season, that's quite not the case. I mean, I've spoken about it a lot on the podcast. This might be the best Juve I have actually ever seen in my lifetime. So do you think the gap that we're seeing in Serie A this season has much more to do with Juve than Napoli? And how do you rate this Juve overall as someone who follows the game very closely?
So this is a great question, and one I really hope to address. Because, like, let's just tell it like it is. Seven Serie A titles in a row, and they signed one of the greatest ever players in Ronaldo. So I have no problems with the way the current table looks like as far as merit. I mean, they've only tied one match. They haven't lost anything. So they've looked unbeatable in the league. I think Inter is going to be a tough test for them. But that being said, I really don't have any hope for Napoli to catch them in the Scudetto race. Although I do see the progress our guys make every week. And I think it just says, it just speaks volumes to the depth, the achievement, and the intelligence that Allegri's side have. We're just not on their level throughout the course of a 38-match season. And I actually am more confident in Napoli's chances to go far in the Champions League than I am in Serie A. Just the, like I said, the way it's set up, Juventus can just week after week tinker around and get those wins in. You've seen, you know, we faltered. We've been fallible every now and then. But again, that's a testament to Juventus' ability, not so much our lack, I'd say.
Yeah, and look, you know, this is something, too, that I feel strongly about, everyone. Every time people bring up Sarri's lack of titles, I'm always like, well, Juve has something to do with that. And I think this season, it's even more evident with that. And I've also said, you know, it'd be a very intriguing title race between Napoli and Inter if Juve was out of the equation, too, because of the differences in the teams and whatnot. So now that we're a third of the season in, you know, Ancelotti's starting to put a lot of his stamp on the team. I still see some elements of Sarri ball there, here and there. So as someone, you know, that scouts the game, understands that side of it, if you had to put a percentage, what's left on what you see of what Napoli was known for under Sarri?
I'd say around 30%, because they still have a lot of possession. A lot of the attacks still go down the left-hand side, but the team is structured differently. Now, I couldn't just look at the team in their current state without thinking about the progress the players made individually under Sarri. So, like, you take someone like Koulibaly, who evolved so much under Sarri. Like, it would be tough for me to brush that off and dismiss that as an achievement. But we really, in some ways, bear little resemblance to the Sarri ball of the years past. So Ancelotti's 4-4-2 has Hamsik often playing as the deepest midfielder, which is a lot different. Insigne's had probably the best start to a season that I can remember from him playing off the striker. Well, Fabian Ruiz has quickly made that left-hand midfield role his own. In possession, it can look a bit more like a 3-5-2 with whoever's playing on at right back, either Maximovic or Husai, pinching in a bit, and then Rui acting as a winger. But Carlo's not afraid to tinker around a bit if things don't go according to plan. So we've seen a fair amount of tactical flexibility and rotation, which is a lot different than when Sarri was under the helm. You always knew what you were getting with that 4-3-3. And I think finally, as we talk about intangibles, the players have spoken pretty frequently about the winning mentality Carlo's brought to the side. And I think that's reflected in the late finishes we've had this season, come from behind wins or getting the point when they were down. So it's good to see that fighting spirit with the side.
Yeah, I certainly agree there. So now let's talk a little bit about the striker position. And, you know, when Ancelotti came, a lot of people pointed out in his career, he's had, you know, a classic number nine, kind of a pivot guy that opens space, more of a big body type of guy. And in a lot of ways, it seemed like this was going to be Milik's breakout season, you know, coming off the injuries he's had in the past. And, you know, there were rumors that maybe Mertens was going to leave for China. But at the beginning of the season, Mertens seemed to have the starting job, and Milik seemed to have the starting job, and that's changed a little bit recently. So give me your perspective on how you think Ancelotti has handled using Mertens and Milik.
I think it's been very fair so far. Going into the season, like you said, I, for one, had high hopes for Milik to come in and make that position his own. But, you know, he did have his share of chances. And then when Mertens came in, he was great. So I think he's averaging something like a goal every 120 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
So you talk about a guy that just always performs no matter how much minutes he gets. And I don't really see it as an issue so much as an added benefit we have to have two incredibly different forwards who can each offer a different dimension to the match. So, like, there's definitely been times where one of them isn't on, and then Carlo will look to the bench, and they'll be able to come off the bench and make an impact. And I think it really just makes us, gives us a lot more depth as an attacking side.
Yeah, and definitely we know last season the team ran out of gas a little bit towards the end, so it's great that they rotated. Look, there were times where we really had no choice because Milik was hurt. So now let's talk about a player you mentioned, and this is Koulibaly, who has been, as usual, sensational. I think he's been the best defender in Serie A since last season. And another guest of the podcast had a bold tweet that really it made me pause and really think. So my friend Kubani tweeted that Koulibaly is the best player Napoli have had since Maradona. And I'm old. I remember watching Diego at Napoli, and I was like, huh, you know, let me think about this. You know, different positions, it's a little bit harder to say. So you're a bit younger than me, so I'm going to ask you this way. I know you've been following the team for a while. Can you make a case that Koulibaly is the best Napoli player you saw play?
You know, I saw the tweet. I thought about it, and in short, yes. I think Koulibaly had a legitimate case for the best player in the world at his position. And yeah, I said he's among the best center backs in the world right now. And in my time supporting Napoli, no one has been comparatively as good at their position. It says it all when I read the stories about clubs like Manchester United bidding $100 million for him. And my first thought is that's not enough.
Yeah.
There's not a chance Napoli could sign a player as good as him for any fee, really. I just don't think we're going to get a player who does so much on a consistent basis. And he's really such a multifaceted player. You see him every match just marshaling the defense. And I think going beyond the tackles and the headers won and the long passes, he's just such a leader of the side.
Yeah, absolutely. Like one-on-one, I think he's as good a defender as I've seen in quite some time. I mean, it's almost a heresy to say, but I remember Franco Baresi at Milan, and that's kind of like Koulibaly one-on-one, what it reminds me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's mighty praise. And, you know, I never got to grow up watching the Milan side of the past just absolutely dominate from the back. But, you know, just hearing that, like, I can't say I'm too shocked, because I've just witnessed him play at such a high level.
I know I'm going to get a lot of tweets from Milan fans on that. I mean, it's close. I know it's kind of hard to say, but it's definitely up there. So I want to ask you about another defender. You mentioned him briefly, and actually a player that Napoli invested a lot in and that was really an afterthought on the Saturday, and that's Maksimovic, who Ancelotti has kind of reinvented in different roles, you know, starting at right back. But you mentioned that sometimes it's like a chameleon back three. So tell me a little bit, are you surprised that Ancelotti's played him as much? And what do you think he brings to the table compared to Hizaj, who at least in the starting lineup, he tends to be the player that he replaces?
So I think it's great that Maksimovic has gotten like a second lifeline from Carlo. And I can't say, you know, it's definitely deserved, because he performed well versus Liverpool in particular. I thought he did a very good job of isolating the attack and midfielders when he was playing. We've really just looked like such a better defensive side having him in the team. And, you know, you talk about someone who is linked away from the club, maybe when he was on loan, people thought that Bartek might move to make him fully under contract by them. So it's just great to see a player like him get a second opportunity to impress, because you look at players like that all the time who don't necessarily get the opportunity, but very different under Carlo. So I like him a lot defensively. And if you actually look, he's conceded, like when he plays, Napoli have conceded comparatively a lot less than they have when Hussai plays. So I think it's it also opened up some healthy competition in that right back slot, which can never be bad for the squad as well. You know, I'm all about rotating players and getting the most out of the team while making sure they don't burn out, which has, as we mentioned, been a problem in the past. Sorry.
Yep. So now I'm going to bring up a touchy subject, and trust me, I feel your pain because I'm disappointed a little bit too. And this is a Diarra, player that at Bologna was absolutely sensational. Very young player, showed some flashes at Napoli. But last season, we know Sarri didn't rotate that much. I remember one match towards the beginning of last season where Diarra started against Spal over Jorginho, and it really wasn't that great. And Sarri brought Jorginho back in, and after that, he kind of became an afterthought, except for the Champions League, which to me, Napoli was punting anyway. And this season, I have to say, I'm kind of seeing a little bit of the same. So, and this is a player that I like a lot, and I know you feel the same way about him. So tell me your perspective on his performances, and do you think it's possible you and I and other people that put him on a pedestal might have overrated him a little bit over a small sample size?
So let me start off by saying that it hasn't been the start of the season, I hope, for Diarra, especially after that early appearance against Milan where I thought he really came in, changed the game. I was like, wow, this is going to be great. It's going to see more minutes from here. It's really going to take off. This is where it's going to go. But no, it didn't really happen. That being said, I still rate him extremely highly and have high hopes for his future. And I'll just come right out and say it. Maybe I'm wearing the tinted glasses, but I still think he'll develop into a top midfielder. But we have to look at and explore different ways for him to get out there and get playing. So we've seen, for example, how Bakayoko can look like such a different player now that he's at Milan. Night and day versus his time when he was playing for Chelsea. So a loan move might be the best option to get him consistent playing time, but I wouldn't even give anyone the option of a clause to buy. Really, when I see him play, I just think he's got such a talented skill set and his upside is so high that it wouldn't even make sense to sell him yet. And the players Napoli have been linked, like potential midfielders like Tonali and Barella, I don't think they're discernibly better than him for the time being. So I really hope that a player that the board and Carlo invest in, and they look to the future and how they can continue to integrate him.
Yeah, I'm with you, because I have a feeling he goes to another team or something. It's possible he really, really strives. And, yeah, I definitely wouldn't replace him with Tonali. I've watched him just a little bit, and I think I'm already overwhelmed by all the hype I'm hearing on him. But let's talk about a player who has lived up to his hype, and this is Fabian Ruiz, a player that Napoli invested significantly in the summer, despite already having an excellent midfield. And this season he's been outstanding. I haven't given up my membership on the Milinkovic-Savic Appreciation Society, but I'm also about to start one for Fabian Ruiz because he checks a lot of my boxes. So tell me a little bit, what's been your impression of him so far?
I think Fabian is a special player. He's brilliant on and off the ball and just so adaptable to come in to that left-hand side. I think a lot of our success comes down to how well he was able to transition to that left-sided midfield role and read the game so well to pinch in when needed, to interplay well with Rui, Insigne, Hamsik. And like the times when we have the ball and Napoli switches to like a 3-5-2, we've seen a lot of patient like back passing and looking to find the perfect through ball to feed forwards. And I think a lot of that is because we have a player like Fabian who can play those passes, and he's just so smart in possession. His touch is beautiful, and really I think once he adds a little bit more depth to his game going forward, then I think you're looking at just an overwhelmingly complete midfielder. There's been a couple times he's gotten really good attacking positions this season and has looked to pass rather than shoot, so I would like to see him be a little bit more aggressive on that foot. But other than that, you know, I have no complaints at all. He tackles hard. He's just the type of guy that has quickly become one of the key players on the side. Like when I think about Napoli's best players, you know, you think Koulibaly, you think Insigne, you think Elan, but I also think Fabian Ruiz.
Yeah, he kind of reminds me a little bit of prime Hamsik, and I could see him kind of developing into that type of player. So your insight in football is fantastic. If you dig what you hear, definitely follow Aaron at Ready Campania. But I want to close on this. You know, on this podcast, we like to talk about pop culture. And, you know, a lot of times you'll tweet me or you'll send me a message on, you know, new music that I should check out. You know, I'm old and I listen to my oldies, but I like to branch out a little bit. This year, you recommended that I listen to that new Arctic Monkeys album. I loved it. I don't think a lot of other people did, but I did. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Any other albums that stood out to you this year? It doesn't have to be rock. I know you're into rap. You have a wide range. So tell our listeners a little bit some of the albums you enjoyed this year.
Yeah, so I think overall probably my favorite is Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer. There's just a lot going on that record. It's fusion of funk, soul, rap, rock. So has it all. Definitely one of my favorites. I know, continuing with the rap one, there's like two other big albums that I've just listened to constantly this year, and that's Pusha T's Daytona. Very short but sweet record, and just hard hitting from start to finish. So that's one that hypes me up in the morning. And I also really like Fetty, which was a collaboration album between Currency, Freddie Gibbs, and The Alchemist, who's the producer. And they all have a very contrasting style, but it just somehow works so well. And then finally, another one I really loved was Beach House, who came out with their 7th studio album, just titled 7. Just like a sonically beautiful dream pop album. A lot of instrumentals. It's a good one to listen to when I'm like just unwinding or on the commute home. So those are some of my favorite records. But I thought it was, you know, it was a great, great year for music. I could probably go on and on about albums I enjoyed, but those are probably my favorites.
Awesome. Well, listen, Aaron, you've been an outstanding guest today. I think it was one of your best you know, appearances on the show. Thanks again for all your contributions to the podcast this year. I look forward to chatting with you in the new year. And thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks again, and Forza Napoli.